Welcome to Face the Jury, the podcast dedicated to confronting the issues of medical malpractice in America, what it is, how to spot it, and how to protect you and your family from medical negligence. I'm your host, Lloyd Bell, a medical malpractice trial lawyer representing people who've been harmed by medical negligence. For more information, visit us at belllawfirm.com. This episode of Face the Jury is brought to you by our friends at Hughes B Reporting, the nationwide leader in court reporting, videography, and trial services. Visit HughesB.com for more information. That's HUSEBY.com. Welcome to Face the Jury. Today we have a special guest, my friend and fellow warrior, Laura Shamp. Laura is a trial lawyer here in Atlanta. She also specializes in medical malpractice cases. And I recently had the pleasure of trying a case with Laura as co-counsel and achieving one of the largest verdicts in medical malpractice in Georgia history. I'm very proud of the verdict, very proud of the work we did, and it was such a pleasure working with Laura, and I'm very grateful that she can be here with us today. So it is my pleasure to welcome Laura to the show. Welcome, Laura.
Great. Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're going to jump right into it and talk about the case that we worked on recently and achieved a verdict about 3 weeks ago, the case of Jonathan Buckaloo versus North Fulton Hospital. Tell us a little bit about the case, the story of the case, what happened to Jonathan, and then I'd like to talk about the trial. So tell us about it.
So this was a medical malpractice case. As you know, it was a very complex case in that we had a lot of parties that we had to wrangle. So just sort of starting from the beginning, John Buckaloo was a 32-year-old man who worked in IT. He was married, just living his life, and had some neck pain and went to a chiropractor. The chiropractor did a neck adjustment, and when he did that, it caused a blood clot to be thrown up into John's brain, causing a stroke. It's called a brain stem stroke in the back of his brain. The chiropractor called 911. He was immediately transferred to North Fulton Hospital, where he was seen by a ER doctor. The ER doctor did not recognize that this was a stroke, sent him for some imaging. They did the imaging. The radiologist missed a clot that was appearing in the basilar artery. Because he missed it then, did not transmit that information to the ER doctor. There was then a phone call to a neurologist. There was a dispute about what was said on that phone call. But the upshot is that a lot of medical care providers that saw John Buckaloo while he was in the hospital missed that he was having this stroke. He ended up, because there was a delay and they didn't diagnose it, as you probably have heard many times, time is very critical in diagnosing and treating a stroke. John went almost 24 hours before his stroke was diagnosed, and at that time there was no treatment available. So he ended up being locked in, which is a condition where he is cognitively intact. He can understand, he can think, but he's unable to speak and he's unable to move any part of his body other than his eyes. So he communicates by lifting his eyes up and down. And so we tried this case against those medical providers for 3 weeks and got a very good result.
Well, Laura, let me ask you a couple of points. You and I have been talking about this case in the community. We've talked with the media and really trying to raise public awareness about the dangers of chiropractic neck adjustments and the dangers of medical error. So talk to us first about chiropractic. Answer the question that a lot of folks have, which is, number one, I thought chiropractic was safe. How can this cause a stroke? And number two, why wasn't the chiropractor part of the lawsuit or part of the trial?
I think the answer is that chiropractors can be a very helpful resource as long as they stay in their lane. I think that, you know, people get relief when they get some adjustments to their lower backs, but never let a chiropractor adjust your neck.
What is a neck adjustment? Tell us what that is.
So that would be taking the head and turning it quickly to try and adjust the cervical spine. Just don't ever let anybody, a doctor, anybody jerk on your neck. A friend, because there's very sensitive arteries that go through the neck that carry blood to the brain. if those arteries are damaged, it can cause a stroke. And in fact, that's the leading cause of stroke in people who are young, is some sort of adjustment, or it can happen in trauma with a car wreck, but some kind of injury to the neck that then causes a blood clot to be thrown into the brain. So I'm not, you know, anti-chiropractic in general, but I do think that they need to, the chiropractors need to stay in their lane, and people who go to chiropractors need to be informed and never get your neck adjusted.
Now, in this case, Jonathan went to the chiropractor. He had been having some neck pain, and the chiropractor did this neck manipulation. And within just a few moments of the manipulation, Jonathan became severely neurologically altered. He started foaming at the mouth. He lost the ability to speak. He was awake, but he was cognitively impaired. How did that happen? How can that happen so quickly from a chiropractic adjustment?
So not to get too deep into the weeds, but you have four arteries that supply blood to your brain. The first two you've probably heard about. If you're taking a pulse, you put your fingers on your carotid. But the two arteries in the back of your brain are called your vertebral arteries. And what we believe happened in this case was that John's vertebral artery, one of the arteries in the back of the brain, had been damaged. And it could have happened by, you know, lifting weights in his case, we think was, or sneezing violently. But that injury to the artery, the body then formed a blood clot around that slight injury. That was why he was having neck pain. When the chiropractor violently turned his neck, it threw a blood clot off of that little injury, and that blood clot then traveled up into the smaller arteries in the brain and clogged one of them. And that's what a stroke is. A stroke is anytime a blood supply to a part of the brain is cut off by usually by a blood clot. And so that's what happened in this case.
And a clot in the brain is never a good thing. And this particular clot lodged in the part of the brain called the basilar artery, which is the blood supply for the brainstem, a really bad part, really dangerous part of the body for a clot to form. Talk to us about what the doctors did wrong. Okay, Jonathan shows up at the emergency room. He's had this clot lodged in his basilar artery. What did the doctors and the medical providers do wrong?
Well, we'll start with the ER doctor. So the critical piece in this case, and what we had to educate the jury about, is that doctors know this association between a neck adjustment and stroke. They're taught it in medical school. And even the ER doctor admitted that he knew that. And so when John came in with this sudden change in his mental status while he's getting a neck adjustment, stroke should have been number one on the ER doctor's differential, on his list of things that this could be. But it wasn't. Even though it was on his list, it wasn't at the top, and he didn't call a stroke alert. When you call a stroke alert in every hospital that takes stroke patients in the state, that sets certain things in motion, sets times, things have to happen quickly, and then everybody knows, oh, the ER doctor suspects stroke. That didn't happen. So the ER doctor misses the stroke in the first instance, doesn't call a stroke alert. When the patient goes to the radiologist to have imaging done of his brain, because a stroke alert is not called, the radiologist doesn't have stroke on his potential. But when he looks at the imaging, he misses the blood clot. It was there. It was visible. The testimony at trial showed he was very busy. He was looking at a lot of films quickly, and just did not have the attention he should have had. Because he didn't see that stroke, then he didn't call it. And so when the ER doctor then decides to call a neurologist, who is a brain specialist, he gets on the phone with him. The brain specialist doesn't know that stroke is suspected, and so he goes down a different trail. He goes down meningitis trail. There is a he said, she said aspect to the trial where the ER doctor says one thing is said, the neurologist says another thing is said. But we allege that the neurologist should have asked more questions, should have gotten a more detailed history. And then after that, there was a PA that met, as you can tell, this is complicated. There was a PA that then came in, didn't recognize that this was a stroke. And then the patient went up to the ICU. The ICU nurses didn't recognize that this was a stroke. So I guess broad brush, the doctors and the other medical care providers didn't recognize that this patient was suffering from a stroke.
I want to take a moment to acknowledge that this episode of Face the Jury is brought to you by our friends at Hughesby Reporting, the nationwide leader in court reporting, videography, and trial services. I have been working with Hughesby for a number of years, and the things that I like best about them are they are incredibly reliable, they have high-quality court reporters, and their post-production is just excellent. They get the transcripts to us on time. They're very diligent with the exhibits and making sure they're properly organized. And when you're taking a deposition, and as many depositions as we take at Bell Law Firm, that reliability is critical. And we are very pleased to have them as our sponsors. And I would encourage any trial lawyers out there or defense lawyers who want that reliability and that level of service to contact our friends at Hughesby and visit them at Hughesby.com. That's Hueseby.com. The point you make about people, you know, the he said aspect of it, the lack of communication, the miscommunication. You and I both do a lot of medical malpractice cases, and this seems to be almost a universal theme in these cases, is people are not talking to each other. And it's in this case, you know, we saw that with the ER doctor not communicating effectively with the neurology consult, and the radiologist claiming that he called the ER doctor to report the imaging studies, but nothing being documented that he did that, which is standard of care that you have to document these things. So this lack of communication, I think, was seemed like just a major theme at this hospital where people just weren't talking to each other.
That was absolutely a theme during trial. And a lot of times the, you know, you'll be in a situation where the family wasn't present, or this family was there the whole time. They were trying to get people to help them. And the physicians just were not communicating with each other. And that was a big reason, I think, why John didn't get the care he needed and deserved.
So you touched on the outcome, which is this condition known as locked in. And I remember your opening statement, which was wonderful. And you told the jury that there are a lot of names for different types of diseases, but locked-in syndrome really describes what we're talking about, where the patient, in this case, Jonathan Buckelew, is literally locked into his body, where his brain is perfectly functional. He can think, he can feel, have all the emotions and experiences of a normal brain, but the cables have been cut essentially to his lower body. So he can't swallow, he can't have any real sensation below his body, he can't move his limbs. Talk to us about the challenges of representing somebody who is so severely injured and telling his story at trial.
That's a great question. This is such a devastating injury that when we talk to people about it, a lot of times people's response is, I'd rather not be alive, that he is so disabled, that he is so dependent on other people. And so part of the challenge that we faced during this trial was to convince the jury, or explain to the jury, that John really did want to live and he really did have a life that was worth living. And so we decided, you and I decided, that we should have John come in and testify, which was a task. I mean, because he's in a wheelchair that somebody has to be with him 24, he has to be suctioned. It was a production. But I thought it was important for the jury to get to see John and to understand that he did. And I think he did a beautiful job when he came to trial. It was very short. We only had him on the stand maybe 15 minutes.
Yeah. Well, you had worked on this case for years before I got involved. And you and I have been friends for many years and talk about cases. We'll go to legal events and people are, you know, standing around talking and enjoying the event, and you and I would typically start talking about cases, and you and I started talking about this case, but you had been in it for a number of years before I ever had met Jonathan or knew his story. Talk to us about the challenges of bringing this case and preparing this case for trial, all those years of work. Tell us what went into it. if somebody says, well, how did you got a big verdict? This verdict was a $75 million verdict, would be believed to be the largest verdict in Georgia history for a medical malpractice trial. I'm very proud of the verdict. But talk to us about the amount of work and what went into the preparation before we showed up for trial.
Yeah, I think the thing people don't understand is when this first case first came to me, I had no idea, and the family had no idea what had happened. They just believed that something went wrong. In fact, some of the doctors had hinted to them that something was not right and that they needed to get the medical records. So they got the medical records, and then through, you know, my contacts in the medical community, that case, because I had a specialty in medical malpractice, came through my door, and I was literally given 13,000 pages of documents and said, see if you can figure out what happened. And we didn't know that the family didn't know the radiologist had missed the blood clot. That was never told to them. And so the first thing I did after I looked at the records, I sent it to a neurologist and I said, tell me, what do you see here? And he called me immediately. He goes, do you know that there is a clot in the basilar artery? So that's sort of how it began. But the first step is that you have to investigate who fell below the standard of care, what different care providers were negligent. And so that involves hiring experts, sending the records to the experts. I probably communicated with 20 different experts. There were over 50 depositions taken in the case, because once you've discovered who all is going to be sued in this case, then every law firm in town who's on the defense side starts asking for depositions. So this was years and years and years of depositions, learning the medicine, working with these expert witnesses, taking the depositions of all the defendants' experts. It was a lot of work.
A lot of work. And I remember when you talked to me about this trial, this case, and said, we're hopefully going to get this case tried in the next year or so. You invited me to come on board and to work with you on the case. And we had a couple of trial settings before we finally got our trial date, which was about a month ago, or 2 months ago, I guess, when trial started. So I'd like you to talk to us about the trial. I mean, we have a lot of listeners who are not in the legal profession, but people with an interest in healthcare and being, keeping their families safe. Talk to us about the trial and about how some of the lessons learned from this case.
Well, first, from a family perspective, let me address that, because one thing I do tell my clients, I tell my family members is that you have to be an educated patient. And I don't mean be on Google and learn. I mean, ask questions of your doctor. Why are you doing this? What is going on? And then this extra piece, which this case taught me, is have you spoken to the other doctors about this, and can I speak to them? You shouldn't have to do that, but it wouldn't be a bad idea if your one doctor comes in and says, the neurologist says this, the next step might be, I want to speak to the neurologist. The next step might be, I want to know what the treatment options are, right? One really interesting piece, which I didn't learn, which everyone should know, is that you have a right when you're in a hospital to talk to your doctor. And if you ask to speak to a doctor and the nurse says he'll be by in the morning, you say, no, I want to talk to the doctor now. And the standard of care for nurses is they have to get a doctor on the phone. And you might have to be the squeaky wheel. But there's a big difference between somebody telling somebody, telling somebody, telling somebody, and you telling the doctor and the doctor telling you. So that would be one sort of public service announcement that I would make, is that when you have rights as a patient and as a family of a patient, and you need to assert those rights.
And before you talk about the trial, Laura, I want to pick up on this point because it's so important. There's this vulnerability that you feel as a patient when you're in a hospital, and there's a psychological vulnerability as well as a physical one, but you don't want to anger. There's a tendency not to want to anger your healthcare providers. You don't want to be obnoxious. You don't want to be intrusive. There's this tendency to just want to be cooperative because you're truly afraid that if you are annoying and obnoxious, you're not going to get the care or your loved one's not going to get the care they need. So a lot of patients walk this line of trying to be polite and deferential, and I want them to like me so that they'll pay attention and the nurse will come by. So there's that impulse. But what I tell a lot of my clients and friends and people I know is you have to be educated, but you also have to be an advocate. And part of your advocacy is to take notes. And we all have the ability to record conversations, audio record, not video record, but audio record. And I encourage people to pull out their phones and say, well, doctor, I want to make sure I understand this. Is it okay if I just record this conversation so I can reference it and process it? And most doctors, nurses will say, yes, that's fine. I would encourage people to do that, or at least to take handwritten notes at the time, take pictures of the monitoring equipment of their loved one so that they can see what the vitals are and share that information. But we all have the ability to do that now with our phones, and we need to really be mindful to use those tools because it can make a big difference.
And I think you're absolutely right about this. You don't want to anger, but you can do it in a polite way. You can do it respectful way, but you should also know what your rights are. And the right to speak to a doctor directly is a very important right that you have. And if someone denies you that right, I learned too, you know, can I talk to him on the telephone? He doesn't have to come in. That's one option. You know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. You might not feel like, well, maybe I shouldn't bother. Then you can talk to him on the phone. And by the way, they are being paid to do that job, right?
That's a great point. And we lose that point. We have this tendency to think that these are the healthcare providers are a special class of citizen, a privileged elite class. And the fact is they are paid to, and they're paid well, very well, to do a job. And they are expected to do that job correctly like anybody else. A mechanic working on your car, they're expected to do their job so that your wheels don't fall off on the highway. So that helps juries. I've noticed it helps juries a lot when they think in terms of, well, this isn't that complicated. They've got a job. I need to understand what their job is. Do they do it correctly or do they do it incorrectly? And if they did it the wrong way, do they cause harm? You know, it's pretty basic.
And I'm a consumer as a patient. I am paying for that service, whether it's through my insurance company, whether it's through Medicare that I paid for. But I am paying for this service and I'm entitled to, good service.
You and I have talked about this before, but I get the question a lot of, well, you know, my father was a doctor. You know, why are you suing doctors? Are you anti-doctor? Are you anti-medicine? And my response is always the same. No, I'm very pro-doctor, but I'm pro-good care. I'm pro-patient and pro-patient safety. Those are the priorities. It's not protecting folks who don't do their job correctly, but it's about holding folks accountable when they don't do their job because that makes the system safer. Two parts to it, I always tell folks. It's not just the primary role is to get a fair, just outcome for your client. But there's a secondary benefit to these cases in that it changes behavior. It raises awareness. And if there's a potential for a $75 million verdict, as there was here, then that gets attention and hopefully changes behavior so that there's not another Jonathan Buckaloo who's living in this way.
Absolutely.
I'll get off my soapbox on that point, but I think it was important to mention. Laura, we appreciate your time today, and I know we still have a lot more to talk about. We're going to continue this conversation in the next episode, and we look forward to seeing everyone back here on Face the Jury.